Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Emmett Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People, where our goal is to look beyond the superficial and reveal the essence, to explore hidden dimensions of life's challenges, and discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of mind, body, emotion, behavior, and spirit on both the individual as well as the collective level.
And I'm here with Joe and Teresa Graydon, the creators of the People's Pharmacy. We'll be talking with them about a number of things, but especially about their newest book, which is called Recipes and Remedies. Joe and Terry, welcome to Healing Times.
Thank you so much, Emmett.
It's wonderful to be with you, Emmett.
You too. How many books have you guys written now? About 14, isn't it?
Actually, we do tend to lose count, but that's about right.
Starting from what, 1976?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. And what got you started in this somewhat alternative direction?
Well, really, what kind of got us started were questions from our audience, people who were reading the newspaper column, people who were listening to the radio show, wanted to know more about herbs. And this was back in the mid-90s when Dechet had just been passed, and everyone all of a sudden was being inundated with information, some of it good and some of it not so good, about herbs, and people wanted to know. So I said, there is research on this. We should look at it. And that's really how we started. It turns out now there's an incredible amount of research on how exercise and diet can have a profound impact on our health.
Yeah, I remember back in the old days, of course, there was always that adage, you are what you eat. And the people who believe that and arrange their lives around it, they were often referred to as, wasn't it, food faddists? I mean, the ones.
Well, that part of it was that they were considered food faddists, but they were also considered flaky. They were considered, you know, granola, fruits and nuts kind of people.
Wackos.
I mean, you know, mainstream medicine said, well, nobody's going to follow that kind of approach. People like, you know, meat and potatoes. You know, vegetarianism, it's a fad, it'll go away. And of course, it hasn't gone away, and we now are seeing that cardiologists are indeed very interested in what people are eating, but it's not just cardiologists, it's neurologists, it's rheumatologists. So seemingly, it took about 30, almost 40 years, but mainstream medicine is beginning to recognize and embrace the idea that, yes, indeed, what we put in our mouths has a profound effect on our bodies. All you have to do is talk to a diabetes expert to realize how concerned they are.
Yeah. Yeah, really. So tell us a little bit about about remedies and recipes, and what do you address in your new book?
Well, let's start with breakfast.
Okay.
Because, you know, Grandma kind of knew this intuitively.
She always said that breakfast was the most important meal of the day, and we've heard, in fact, there's even some epidemiological research from Northern California showing that people who eat breakfast tend to live longer, and, you know, who knows why. Well, there's actually some recent research in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition showing that children who eat breakfast and continue to eat breakfast into adulthood are much less likely to develop metabolic syndrome, which puts them at risk of cardiac disease. Mm-hmm.
And it's not just eating breakfast. although that's important, it's what you eat for breakfast. So millions of Americans grab and go. You know, grab a cup of coffee. Maybe if they're thinking healthy, they grab some cereal, maybe a banana or a bagel and some and a glass of orange juice. And they figure, okay, I've done something good for my body. Now I can go off to work or go off to school or go off to whatever. Well, it turns out that that all-American breakfast is all bad.
Uh-huh.
There's almost nothing good about it because it is what we call very high in glycemic load. That means these are high-carb breakfasts. They raise blood sugar. They raise insulin. And then people crash and burn. So by 9:30, 10 o'clock, they have to have a second or third cup of coffee just to make it through the morning, or maybe a Danish, which is going to, once again, raise their blood sugar very quickly, and then they're going to crash and burn.
It turns out that if people were to eat, for example, scrambled eggs, which, you know, horrifies some nutritionists, they'd actually do much better over the course of the morning. They wouldn't really need a snack until lunchtime.
So what we've actually done in the book is we've prepared a number of breakfast remedies, recipes, if you like, that kind of combine both great breakfast nutrition to get you through the morning, but also some, for example, anti-inflammatory properties. So we have what we call our curcumin scramble.
And this is a scrambled eggs, uses some proportion of egg whites, which are now easy to come by in the supermarket. So it's scrambled eggs with egg white with turmeric. And the turmeric actually has very powerful anti-inflammatory activity.
Neat. Very neat. And then do you take us through the day with different meals, for different recipes for different meals?
Oh, yes, absolutely, because you can't get by on breakfast alone. You have to have meals for, you know, lunch. You have to have something for supper. And we even have a number of really healthy, delicious side dishes, but we also have a couple of delicious and helpful dessert.
But before we move off breakfast completely, I have to share with you one of my favorite breakfasts. It's called Joe's Smoothie. And when people think of smoothies, they usually think of very high sugary, high carb kind of dessert treats. But in point of fact, you can put together a smoothie that is relatively low in sugar. So, yes, there are berries, and I'm very big on blackberries, blueberries, raspberries, or my latest favorite, black raspberries, which are very high in antioxidants. And based on some really landmark research out of New England suggesting that these kinds of berries really do have powerful brain-boosting power for neuronal function. We start with the berries, but we add low-fat yogurt, we add whey powder for protein, we add pasteurized egg whites, we add some flax, ground flax seed for fiber, and I like to put in pomegranate juice because there's a lot of data now suggesting that pomegranates have really wonderful healing properties, not just to lower blood pressure, but perhaps anti-inflammatory properties, lowering cholesterol as well. I throw in a little beet juice now and again because there's some marvelous data from the UK suggesting that beet juice can lower blood pressure about as well as some of the blood pressure medications that we have on the market. They affect something called nitric oxide,
uh-huh,
which tends to be very important for relaxing blood vessels.
Uh-huh.
So you put all of this together, and you end up with the most delicious smoothie that's extremely high in protein and will get you through the morning and will have some pretty interesting neurophysiological effects, anti-inflammatory effects, blood pressure lowering effects, probably lower cholesterol as well, And the nice thing about this is that kids really like it too. So it's a great way to get them off to a good start without all of that sugar.
Not only that, but it only takes about 3 minutes to put it together. So even when you're in a hurry in the morning, it's hard to say, oh, I don't have time to make a smoothie. It hardly takes any time.
Well, that sounds like a very good recommendation. I'm going to be trying that one sometime soon. Great. So, okay, what about lunch?
Well, there are quite a few things that can make a really tasty lunch. One of the things that we like is something we call a Mediterranean salad, which has, along with the greens, some a little hard-boiled egg, some tuna, some walnuts. It's delicious and, once again, has all those healthy fats, the omega-3 fatty acids, and it sustains you until supper time.
You know, we frequently get an opportunity to talk with some of the country's leading nutrition experts. Two of our favorites, Dr. Walter Willett, who is chairman of nutrition at Harvard and arguably one of the world's foremost epidemiologists, and Dr. Christopher Gardner from Stanford. And we asked both of them for their favorite recipes. Interestingly, both of them recommended a lentil recipe. So Dr. Willett and his wife have suggested a lentil nut loaf. Now, I have to be honest with you. I am not the world's greatest lover of lentils, but Dr. Willett's lentil nut loaf is surprisingly delicious.
Well, among other things, it has walnuts in it, so there's an interesting textural contrast with the lentils. And lentils, of course, are full of B vitamins. They're extremely rich nutritionally. And then this loaf with the walnuts just tastes great. It's not difficult to put together. And in addition to walnuts, it's got some whole wheat bread in the form of breadcrumbs to kind of help it hold together. It's got mushrooms. And then there's the red pepper sauce. That's also very easy to put together, makes it look beautiful and taste, and really just sparks the taste.
Well, fascinating. But that was interesting in what you were saying, Joe, that that really the some of the top voices in the medical field are now coming around to understanding the real importance of what we eat. And I think, you know, most people by now have heard of the metabolic syndrome and pretty much how it's been devastating the health of our country. And then at a time where we're all very interested in health care and who gets to have health care, we're talking here about preventing illness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exactly the point. Because what we have seen over the last 20 years is an epidemic of obesity and an epidemic of diabetes. And both of those things can be prevented in part by what we put in our mouths and how we move our bodies. So in the case of what we put in our mouths, we were told 20, 25, 30 years ago that fat was the enemy. And so you had this huge food industry supplying us with low-fat, high-carb, high-sugar foods. And what good did it do us? Well, I would argue it did us a great deal of harm, because in the process, we just got fatter, and we just have more and more diabetes. Nowadays, I think people are recognizing that fat is not the enemy. You have to be thoughtful about the kind of fat you consume. But maybe it's the carbs that are the problem. Now, not entirely the problem, but so much of what we eat has sugar in it, either in the form of, out-and-out corn-based fructose.
Right, high fructose corn syrup, or even sucrose, whether it's from beets or cane.
And it's a hidden ingredient in many foods, but we've all seemingly developed a sweet tooth as a result of all this food. that's so sweet, and our kids in particular, with all of the snack foods. And we're all so busy, we're all so stressed out, so we think that these so-called comfort foods are going to be good for us, and of course what they've turned out to be is very, very bad for us. So I think that the nutrition establishment is beginning to recognize that this thing we call the metabolic syndrome, where we have extra pounds around our belly, where our triglyceride levels are very high, where our cholesterol is elevated, where our blood pressure is high, all of these things are going to lead to diabetes and cardiovascular complications. So changing the way we eat and starting at the earliest age possible, where we really set down these patterns, is going to have a profound impact on the likelihood of developing so many of the chronic ailments that affect us today.
And this can even have effects on mental health. Exercise and diet actually do make a difference when it comes to depression, for example, which is so rampant.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. When you look at the data as carefully as we have when it comes to antidepressant medications, you discover that most of the studies, published and unpublished, do not demonstrate much, if any, benefit from some popular antidepressants treating mild to moderate depression.
Do you mean
drugs like Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft and Cymbalta and Lexapro and Pristiq? I mean, you can go down this entire list, and we've spent $10 billion a year on these drugs, most of them on mild to moderate depression, with little, if any, data to suggest that they're effective. Now, no one will argue that these drugs can work for people who are severely depressed, and we would never suggest that anyone should stop taking such medication. But for mild to moderate depression, it turns out that what we eat, how we exercise, our social interactions, how much sun we get or how much light exposure, that all of the things that we've kind of known about intuitively and that grandma was aware of for a very long time could actually make perhaps a greater impact on our mental health than all of the antidepressants in the pharmacy. So we're kind of back to basics. And it astonishes me that, you know, it has taken us so long to realize that grandma had a great deal of wisdom.
Oh, boy, it's really remarkable that that many billions of dollars have been spent on medications that probably for three-fourths of the people who are taking them, they really haven't done any good. And certainly harm, because most drugs have side effects that affect a certain percentage of people, and sometimes severely.
Well, Sharon Begley wrote a wonderful article in Newsweek a couple of months back in which she said that a lot of our antidepressants, when used to treat mild to moderate depression, are just expensive Tic Tacs. In essence, pricey placebos with side effects.
Oh.
So you're right. I mean, these are very expensive medications. And it's not like they're placebos in that they're benign. They don't have much, if any, effectiveness. But they do have complications.
Wow. So how do I go about then looking at the dietary aspects? I've been mildly or moderately depressed recently, and you know, how should I look at my diet?
Well, one thing you'll want to look at your diet is to see whether you have adequate sources of omega-3 fats. And as you know, these are the fatty acids that are found predominantly in fish and fish oil. So you might want to see if you are eating fish two or three times a week. That would be one place to start. You want to make sure that you are not eating a high glycemic load diet, because pushing your insulin up and letting your blood sugar drop so rapidly, so many times a day, as many people do, is not great for your mood either. And of course, exercise is an absolutely critical component of the of any regimen for mental health.
Now, and we're not talking about activity. You know, walking to the grocery store is not exercise.
It's a good thing to do, but it's not quite enough.
You really do have to get your heart rate up. You do have to start sweating a bit for the antidepressant effect of exercise to really kick in. And then you do need some sunlight. You need to have some exposure to, you know, the midday sun, or if it's dark and cold and rainy where you are, then you may need a sun lamp of some sort, something that's going to provide that ultraviolet radiation. And then you need friends and family and people to talk to. You can't be isolated when you're feeling blue, although that's a very easy thing for people to fall into. When you put together social support, exercise, omega-3 fatty acids, sunlight, you begin to put together a synergistic package that's going to work together to help relieve depression. And, you know, we are very big on talking therapy. There was a time 50, 60 years ago when talking therapy was the only therapy for people who were depressed. We didn't have very good antidepressants. Now we have insurance companies that want to get people, you know, in and out as quickly as possible, as affordably as possible. And so they seem to think that, you know, paying for a prescription for Prozac is the solution. Well, we disagree. We think that sometimes talking with a trained therapist or a counselor or even a rabbi or a minister or a priest, you know, that can have a profound impact on somebody's depression.
Now, it's also true that sleep needs to be part of this integrated regimen, so getting adequate sleep, and of course that can sometimes be a problem for a person who's depressed, but the exercise may help. And actually we spoke to someone not too long ago who said, Emmett, that her sleep problems have gone away since she started listening to your Easing Into Sleep.
Say it's certainly true that the interaction with another human being is extremely important. A human being is a highly social creature. You know, just as we can see, there are certain animals that absolutely need to be with a herd. If you own a horse, if that horse is alone, it's a very unhappy horse. But you can get it another horse, or even a donkey or a goat, and it'll be happy because it's not alone anymore. And we're certainly that social aspect of it. And a great deal, I think, of the talking therapy is if you go in for your 50-minute hour, there's another human being who's paying attention to you, who's taking what you're saying as having some value, and who's responding to you with their own emotions, spiritually responding to you. That alone makes for a big difference. And then if the person that you're talking to knows a little bit about how to help you change your cognitive behavior, you are what you eat, but you are also what you think.
Mm-hmm.
You've absolutely identified, you know, these two key components, because the greatest gift anyone can give another human being, as far as I'm concerned, is listening.
Yeah.
And in our very stressed out, high tension, fast-paced world, we become very impatient if somebody speaks for more than 15 seconds.
Yes.
We want to get our two cents in, and we want to get going.
Yeah, just give me a sound bite.
The idea of actually listening, mm-hmm. Wow, what a gift, mm-hmm. and what a difference it can make for somebody's mental attitude.
So true. So many people think, you know, just give me a sound bite, and I'll run on my way. I don't really want to talk about anything. I don't really want to connect. We'll come back in just a moment and explore a few more dimensions. And I would like to talk just a little bit more about omega-3s and maybe a little bit about vitamin D. And maybe we can even take a look at how dinner can be medicine for us. With
Joe and Teresa Graydon, creators of the People's Pharmacy, which you guys have been doing, what, since about 1976 now, huh?
Yes, we have been writing books, writing newspaper columns, doing radio for about 30-plus years. 1976 was the publication of the first edition of the People's Pharmacy. So after 30 now, I guess 34 years, we're still going strong.
What were your goals in creating this this work?
Well, I think initially it was a recognition that medicine was mysterious. That a lot of doctors were not that well trained in communicating to patients. In fact, they didn't really see the necessity. And that was especially true when it came to drugs. So, you know, go back to the 1960s and 1970s, sort of the beginning of the pharmaceutical revolution, and physicians would write prescriptions in a Latin code. They often didn't tell people any of the side effects that might be associated with the medicine. And if people asked their pharmacist, the pharmacist often would be very reluctant to share that information for fear that it might alienate the physician or that it might scare the people who were taking these pills out of taking them. So I think the initial idea behind the People's Pharmacy was to demystify medicine, especially medications, to tell people about the benefits and the risks, to talk a little bit about home remedies, to give people, you know, the kind of empowerment that has become so popular in the last decade or two, in order to be part of the team, to be informed, to be able to say yes or even no. Because let's face it, there are times when you have a right to say no. I'm not going to take that medicine. That's too much of a risk for me, or the side effects are causing me too many complications. And then it's up to the physician or the prescriber to come up with a different approach. We're not against medicine, never have been. When somebody is having a heart attack, medications can help save their lives. If you've got a bad infection, pneumonia, for example, antibiotics have revolutionized the treatment of those upper respiratory tract infections. But so many of the drugs that we take today, and we take an extraordinary number of them, are neither very effective nor very safe. And so over the course of the last 30-plus years, we've just continued to try and help people be better informed and to avoid some of the missteps, some of the drug interactions, some of the complications that many of the pills that are prescribed today can cause.
Mm-hmm. And I remember back in the 1970s, they did a survey and they asked people the question, who is responsible for maintaining your health? And about 75% of people said, the doctor is. And that's changed considerably. I think right now at least 75% of the people are aware of the fact that every one of us is responsible for our own health. And I think that change is due to people like you and Tom Ferguson and, you know, all the other voices that have come along that says, you know, that we really do need to be responsible for ourselves. The doctor isn't with us all the time. He doesn't choose our breakfast, doesn't choose our friends, or decide whether or not we'll go out to exercise today. I say the downside of that is a little bit of, you know, now the pharmaceutical companies advertise directly to people, and people don't come to see me to say, okay, I've got these symptoms. They say, I come in because I want this new drug that I saw. I say, well, you know, maybe we better take a look at what's going on. Maybe you ought to have a trained person make a diagnosis before we give you a drug that, 3% of the people gain 30 or 40 pounds on. You might want to think about that before you jump into that. So it's, people are aware that they're responsible for their health. I've always felt that your work has really given the right kind of information to people, honest information, caring information. And you've been fair because you're not selling a product yourself.
So I really appreciate the work that you guys have done.
Well, we appreciate your appreciation. And you're absolutely right that that people do need to take the lead, take the responsibility, say, I want to know how I can be the healthiest that I can be. But I couldn't agree more that direct-to-consumer advertising is not a benefit in this regard most of the time.
Mm-hmm. So we had touched on before omega-3s, and so I hear a lot about omega-3s and omega-6 fatty acids being bandied about, and also some question about the value of taking supplements. I know that Dan Amen and other folks are recommending you take 4 to 6 grams of omega-3s every day for stabilizing neuronal membranes and so forth. What are your thoughts on that?
Well,
the acids?
My thoughts are that we don't yet have the final answers. This is very much an area in which science is happening, which means we're asking questions, we're looking for answers. We don't know exactly what the answers are. We thought, for example, that if pregnant women were to get more omega-3s, that their babies would be smarter and healthier. And a couple of recent well-controlled studies have shown no, that actually didn't make any difference. Now, that doesn't mean that it would be good for pregnant women to be deficient in omega-3s, but it does mean that we shouldn't consider this as a magic bullet of some sort.
I do think that, you know, as most of the nutrition experts are beginning to realize, that too many omega-6s are probably what we call pro-inflammatory. So I think there's a, if not a consensus, a growing recognition that the oils that we use to cook with, the corn oil, the safflower oil, the peanut oil, high in omega-6s, are probably not that good. And a lot of the snack food that's high in those kinds of fats, even though we've seen trans fats pretty much disappear, or at least they're on the way out, also high in omega-6s. So none of that is good for us. In the old days, when people ate meat that was actually, we'll call it range-fed, if you like, you know, cattle actually ate grass once upon a time, hard as that is to believe, people were getting omega-3s from their meat. I know that seems like a hard-to-believe fact, but it was probably true 150 years ago. Now, of course, cattle eat a lot of corn, and that changes everything. But we're very big on food. So if you can eat fish, if you like fish, then we think that's a great way to get your omega-3 fatty acids. We have a delicious salmon recipe in the book. It's horseradish crusted salmon that was submitted to us by a physician in Florida who's been very actively involved with the...
Actually Dr. Mark Lapone.
Oh, Dr. Lapone.
Mixed
right.
up, but that's all right. Dr. Mark Laponis is medical director of the Canyon Ranch Spas, and he shared one of their really delicious recipes with us, and that's the horseradish crusted salmon. It uses not the jarred horseradish that you might remember from the grocery store, but now in a lot of supermarkets it's actually possible to get fresh horseradish. You grate it and dip the salmon in it before you saute it, and it is really delicious, very easy to make. And then he has added a cranberry, we're going to call it a cranberry condiment. In the recipe, he calls it cranberry ketchup, but I think ketchup is such a strong term that makes people expect something that's bland and red. Well, this is red, but that's where it's resemblance to ketchup stops.
But I think, you know, what we're saying is you can get a lot of your omega-3 fatty acids from your food, but if you're not big on fish, then you probably are going to need some supplements. Mm-hmm. And that's why we put fish oil into Joe's smoothie, because it's a great way to get your fish oil without tasting like fish oil.
Ah.
Some people complain of that fish oil burp. You won't experience that with the fish oil in the smoothie. So we're kind of big on fish oil. We do think that at least 2 to 3 grams a day is mm-hmm. about the desirable range, especially for people who have arthritis, who may have high triglycerides, who may even have some psychological depression.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned vitamin D. We're also very big on vitamin D, but we think there's a sweet spot. It's kind of like what we call a J-shaped curve. Too little is not good. Too much may not be good.
And so Goldilocks' porridge is probably where we want to be, somewhere in the middle.
Just right. How would we find that sweet spot for each of us?
Well, here again, science is in process, and researchers are looking at this, but it looks as though 20 nanograms per liter is probably too low or a little too low, and 50 or 60 might be the upper limit for really optimal. So somewhere between 20 and 50 is probably just about right for most people. And to find out where you are, there are blood tests.
Right. Next time you go to your doctor, you need to ask for a 25 hydroxy vitamin D level, just as you might ask to have your cholesterol levels or your triglyceride levels monitored, or perhaps your thyroid function checked. So we think that you would want to have, along with those kinds of results, your 25 hydroxy vitamin D levels. And I'd probably say the sweet spot is between 30 and 40, roughly speaking. Now, if I were in a nice, warm, sunny place, I'd want to get probably 15 to 20 minutes of sunshine on my face and on my arms every day, sometime between 11 and 1, not enough to cause damage to my skin, but enough for my skin to make the actual vitamin D itself. If I'm in northern Minnesota at this time of year, I'd probably want to be taking an oral supplement.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you don't have to be in northern Minnesota. Anywhere pretty much, even North Carolina right now, is too far north to be making vitamin D.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what about choline?
Well, choline is a very interesting compound, and it is really critical. The rat research that Dr. Zeisel has done really indicates that a choline-enriched diet while the mother rats are pregnant does make a huge difference for their offspring in terms of their ability to run mazes, which is how we test intelligence in a rat. We have some preliminary evidence on humans, but it's still not altogether there yet. However, it seems likely that choline is really important for brain function.
Mm-hmm.
And, where do you get choline? Well, it turns out egg yolks. And, here we've been told for 30 years that egg yolks are high in cholesterol, don't eat eggs. Well, that was probably very bad advice, especially for pregnant women, because one of the best sources of choline, again, would be the egg yolk or wheat germ. So, again, dial back 30, 40 years to what were referred to as the food faddists of the 70s. They were talking about wheat germ. Well, it turns out wheat germ is really good for you.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure you have some wheat germ on your oatmeal or have a scrambled egg with a whole egg yolk, and now you're going to be getting that choline that's so important, especially if you're pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't there a way I could get some choline by eating cheesecake or something?
You could get choline by eating cheesecake. The cheesecake has in it some low-fat cream cheese, which has a little bit of choline in it, but it, more importantly, it has a number of eggs in it, whole eggs, which provide the choline.
Uh-huh.
And if you add in those blueberries for that blueberry cheesecake, The recipe is delicious and good for us.
And that's...
As long as we don't overdo it. You don't want to have cheesecake every day.
Mm-hmm.
You want to save it for special occasions.
And you have that whole recipe in your new book, Recipes and Remedies, huh?
That is correct.
Okay. Can you tell us about one more? We're going to have to go in a few moments, but maybe you can tell us about one more of your favorite recipes from that book.
Well, actually, what we're going to do is we're going to share one of our remedies with you.
Oh, great.
And that has to do with digestive function. You know, a lot of people end up with irritable bowel syndrome or end up having to run to the bathroom quite frequently. And several years ago, we heard from a gentleman who had Crohn's disease, which is inflammatory bowel disorder. And it was devastating because he had to take high doses of corticosteroids, which caused his bones to melt, and he had had a number of hip replacements.
Hmm.
But bottom line, he started cooking for himself after his wife died, and he bought some Archway coconut macaroon cookies for dessert. And sure enough, within a few days, his diarrhea that had been with him for 30 or 40 years disappeared. He stopped eating the coconut macaroon cookies. The diarrhea came back. He told a friend who was having chemotherapy and having problems to try the coconut macaroon cookies. It worked for him. He shared that with us. We've been now writing about it for many, many years, and a great many people have told us that, indeed, coconut macaroon cookies does seem to help. We think it's the coconut, the shredded coconut. So you don't necessarily have to eat a high-fat snack like the coconut macaroon cookies from Archway to get the benefits. A little shredded coconut on your oatmeal in the morning just might do the trick.
Mm-hmm. Great idea. Okay. One more. One more.
Well,
tip.
One more that we think is not widely appreciated is vinegar for type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that having a little bit of vinegar at the end of the meal, for example, eating your salad last and putting a vinaigrette dressing on it, can actually keep your blood sugar from spiking up the way it sometimes does. And that helps you maintain your blood sugar under better control. It's really quite remarkable. There's very good science, and we've also heard some amazing stories from people who have been able to maintain their blood sugar under excellent control despite their type 2 diabetes.
Excellent. Well, it's been absolutely wonderful talking with you guys. What's in the future? I hear you've got a few more books in the pipeline.
Yes, we seem to be on a continuous book cycle. Our newest book will be devoted almost entirely to our favorite home remedies, quick and handy home remedies, questions and answers from many, many of our listeners. We like to listen.
Mm-hmm.
So we listen to the people who listen to our radio show and share their stories, people who send in their suggestions to our newspaper column or to our website. And so we are sharing some of their wisdom in our quick and handy home remedy book. And then we'll have a new book coming out in a little bit that'll talk about how to protect yourself from some of the dangers that exist in hospitals, especially when it comes to pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, I like to stay as far from hospitals as possible myself.
That's a
good
great
idea.
Way to stay healthy.
Where and when can our folks hear your radio show?
Easy. If they want to just download a podcast, go to peoplespharmacy.com and sign up. We're heard on 125 public radio stations around the country. They can find out which station is nearest them by checking again our website, going to our radio stations, www.peoplespharmacy.com.
Well, it's just been wonderful talking with you, and we'll do it again sometime soon.
Well, thank you, Emmett. It's always a pleasure to hear your voice.
In preparing this conversation with the Gradens for posting, it got me to thinking about that thing that the Gradens and I agree on, that you are what you eat and think. Most people say you are what you eat, but they're not really aware of how important it is what you think. In fact, We've been virtually programmed by the culture and society that we live in to not think. Because if we really thought about things, not just superficially, not just how high my high heels will be or whether I'll get the new Gucci pocketbook or whatever, but for us to really think deeply about things, to know ourselves and make the wise decisions in our lives, it's important that we think a certain way. And we're trained to not think in that way. In that way, it's much easier to sell us on second-rate products and corrupt politicians and false ideas. And one of the ways you can easily see that, in other words, how am I thinking and how is my thinking, you can pay attention to how you feel. Because when your thinking goes off course, when you're not in tune with yourself and with the world around you, then you'll tend to find yourself having certain emotions. You'll find yourself feeling stress in your body or however you feel stress. And after a while, that stress begins to produce an anxiety. The anxiety itself might show itself by your feeling frightened of certain things, or you may have a sort of free-floating anxiety, or you may have a kind of panic reaction where you feel upset and you're really not sure why that is. Or it may express itself in anger or road rage or irritability, or by a sort of obsessive thinking and worrying about things to the detriment of what you're doing, to the detriment of your relationship, being busy, being lost in worrying about something else. Or it may show up as a compulsion in which you keep doing something over and over in your life, even though it actually is causing harm to other people, to yourself, and to your true goals. And at any rate, if you have feelings then, such as anxiety or depression or anger, because after a while of being on edge, of feeling tense about the world, of feeling in conflict, in feeling isolated from the world or at war with the world or with the situation that you're in or other people, it begins to wear you down. And that can show itself by your compulsions being the compulsion to smoke cigarettes, very harmful to your health, or to drink too much or to take other drugs in a way to escape from the uncomfortable feelings inside, or you may get riddled with anxiety, and that anxiety burns you out inside. So there's a pathway from being under stress, which means kind of being in conflict deep within, and then anxiety, which then leads to depression. And what is so specially interesting to me about this is that I've just completed a program with John Robinson, who many of you may know, a very prolific author, fantastic speaker, and who has worked in psychology and has really studied how you become more happy, how can you be more fulfilled in your life. And so we got together and we created a program. It's an audio program, and it's entitled From Sad to Glad: How to Overcome Stress, Anxiety, and Depression and Feel Happy Again. In other words, how to look at this continuum that we have from feeling stressed or feeling anxious or feeling depressed, depending on how out of harmony our inner thoughts are with who we are and the true nature of the world that we're in. And how can you go from that S.A.D. to glad, from sad to glad? And what we discovered in gathering the material for this program is that there are different ways of thinking that we can use. That is to say, if you're feeling stressed or anxious or depressed, there's a certain way that you think about things which is actually keeping you stuck there. And if you change your thinking, then you can basically bring yourself out of that funk, out of the anxiety or depression or whatever you're feeling. And You can begin to do that by thinking not that depression and happiness are totally different, or that happy and sad are totally different, but to think of kind of a continuum that stretches from being totally depressed and miserable and suicidal on one end, and then at the other end is feeling blissfully happy. And at any moment, each of us is at some place on that continuum. There are some people who are always totally depressed, way down at that end. And I don't know many people who are always happy and blissful. I don't know, maybe the Dalai Lama is the closest that one can imagine. But we're all at some place along there, and there are certain ways of thinking that can move you from the depressed end toward the happy end, or from the anxious end up toward the happy end of the cycle. And so the first thing that's important is to learn how to free yourself from disturbing thoughts. In other words, learn how to go into a deeply relaxed or meditative or prayerful state where you feel totally calm and peaceful, and let go of unpleasant emotions. You can teach yourself to do that so that you're simply present. And then from that place of being present, you guide your mind to think in certain ways. A certain mental exercise, and you rehearse thinking in that way. I was a socially shy guy until someplace in when I was in high school, I read a quote by Theodore Roosevelt, and it inspired me, and I changed my life because I kept reading this quote until I memorized it, and then I always said it to myself every day. I said, far better it is to dare mighty things, to win glorious triumphs, though checkered by failure, than to take rank with those poor spirits who neither enjoy much nor suffer much, because they live in that gray twilight that knows neither victory nor defeat. Yeah. And all of a sudden, somehow, maybe it really is better to dare things and to try big things in the world, even if you fail sometime, you know, rather than to give up. And I started to come out of this kind of teenage depression that I had, and went about living my life in the way I really wanted to. So wherever we are on that spectrum between depressed and deliriously happy, stop for a moment, clear your mind of unnecessary thoughts, and feel yourself in the present moment. And then, when you're in that present moment, think your positive thoughts. I accept myself exactly as I am. Or a prayer, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Or whatever other meditation or affirmation works for you. Or in that state, you can visualize something beautiful and positive, maybe a past situation that you can go into and feel yourself feeling juicy and a little bit better, a little happier inside, certainly feeling happier than if you're watching the daily news. And feel that happiness. And imagine that there's a place within you that's constantly trying to give you that happiness. And that by relaxing and thinking this positive thinking, you can awaken that feeling within you and breathe it through your body. And if you practice that, you get better and better at it. And that's why in the From Sad to Glad program, we teach a number of things that you can do to quickly bring yourself out of a little funk. One of them that we describe there is get up and walk around like you're Superman. Imagine you have a cape flowing behind you, or Spider-Man, or whoever your hero might be. And just imagine yourself walking around the room and being that superhero. Let yourself be a child. Because when you let yourself be a child, your brain reconfigures itself into the same form that it had when you actually were a child. And when you're a child, you can learn so much better. And you want to learn what it feels to feel on top of the world, to feel victorious. And so strut around the room. Nobody's looking. Strut around the room. Go, yeah. Ha-ha, I have everything I need. The wind blows through my hair and my cape flutters behind me. You know, or you can imagine yourself being Martin Luther King or George Washington crossing the Delaware or whoever you would want to imagine yourself being. Imagine yourself Mary Baker Eddy or whoever your hero is. Feel that feeling. Because that's the feeling that you want to keep with you. And so after doing that, literally for a minute to a minute and a half, try it. Try it. Just do that. No, pay attention to how you're feeling someday when you're feeling not so great. Get up and strut around for a minute or two or three. You'll get better at it, so pretty soon it only takes a few seconds. But notice, stop, and you do feel better. Well, there's a whole bunch of these that you can use. Different exercises you can train your mind and body to behave differently. And you also need to know that it's important to keep your body in balance. And it's one of the reasons we talked a lot in there about paying attention to what you're eating, paying attention to your exercising. That supports the ability of your body to have that raw feeling of health. And then the more you feel it, the more you can project it ahead into the future. And you can use positive psychology so that you can create the expectations in the future that you want and move toward them. And then, of course, use your inner imagery and so forth. And all these are simply ways of using your mind to think differently and thereby change your stress, your anxiety, your depression, and really feel happy again. Think about that. And if this is even a little bit interesting to you, just take a moment and go to our website. It's fromsadtoglad.com. It's from sad and then the number two, like the Arabic number two, glad.com. fromsadtoglad.com. And check out what we've put together. I think you'll gain a lot from going there, and I hope you enjoy the program.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People, on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.